You are listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. I'm your host, Reed Johnson. Running on Air is a daily radio roundtable conversation with the people running to represent Portland. In this episode, we're talking with candidates from District 1. That's East Portland, east of Interstate 205 and areas surrounding the Portland International Airport. And we want you to join the conversation. You can call the air room with questions for candidates at 503-231-8187. You can also message a question on the website kboo.fm. You can email us your questions at runningonair@kboo.org. Now let's meet our candidates for the day. I have three lovely candidates. I've just been introduced to them. So happy for them all to join us in the KBOO studios. Maybe beginning with Steph to my right, and we could just kind of go down the line. Do you mind introducing yourself? And also, why are you running for city council?
Well, thank you for having us, Reed. And it's just wonderful to be back in the KBOO studio again. My name is Steph Routh, she, they. I am indeed running for Portland City Council District 1, so I guess I'm in the right place. And I would say I'm running. I grew up in Park Rose. I live in Lentz. I've lived east of 82nd Avenue for the majority of my life. And when I saw the new district lines being drawn, it was deeply meaningful to me as someone who identifies as an East Portlander that on the first day of the new administration, we will have more representation from East Portland than in the cumulative history of Portland City Council. Also, I've served for the last 5 years on the Planning Commission. One of the major issues that is before us is around how do we deal with homelessness and the housing affordability crisis. And so I think that that's a skill set that I bring. So thank you.
Thank you. Yeah, and Terrence.
How you doing? Terrence Hayes, also city council in District 1. I think what I bring unique and why I'm running is because I want to really work on that relationship between our police officers and our community. I want to see especially East Portland become a safe place for all people. I want to work on that through relationship building. And I think I bring something unique because of my lived experience to that. I want to work on getting Portland clean again. I think that we have amazing champions like Steph who talk about environmental stuff, and I want to be a student of hers also in that time, but I also want to think about the very practical ways that we just clean our streets and graffiti and things like that every day, which I do as a profession. And I just want to look at affordability from the lens of industrial, the trades, getting private money back into our city and getting folks working and able to afford, as we talk about the housing crisis. A lot of homeless folks and unsheltered folks just cannot afford to live in our city. So I want to make sure we're bringing industry back to our city so that as we can deal with the mental health and drug issues and things like that and houselessness, we won't forget that there is folks that work and they just need good jobs.
And Dean.
Thank you. So what I believe I bring to the table is experience working on several of these issues that the city has been struggling to solve for several years now. I work on the Oregon Commission on Autism. I've been working there for the past few years, as well as a social services co-chair. And one thing that you instantly find out is a lot of issues that people there are struggling with are simply everyday working people's issues magnified. Lack of economic opportunity, lack of alternative career pathways, lack of investment. All these are issues that are severely impacting that community, as well as the homelessness crisis. I've also served on the Portland Children's Levy and other organizations where I've really focused on mental health care, access to mental health, because right now there is so little access to mental health and so little mental health care providers here in Portland that we really need to invest in that big time if we are going to solve the homelessness crisis. So I believe that I bring that in addition to I'm the candidate who is the most diverse in the sense of being Latino. I have autism. My father was half Jewish. My grandfather has Pueblo. My grandparents immigrated here, immigrated to America from Mexico. So I have all these identities. that intersect uniquely with East Portland, because we are the district with the most people with disabilities, the most low-income communities. We are the most diverse, and we are also the least invested in. And so I want to ensure that that community gets fought for just like I would fight for my own, because in a way, it really is my own.
Well, thank you for all those responses. And I'm going to maybe reverse the order now and begin with Dean. I did some background research, Dean. I saw that you have run for public office before you ran for David Douglas School Board, if I'm not mistaken.
Yes.
I wanted to ask you, what lessons or values do you draw from this previous experience running, you know, applying it to your current campaign?
Yes. So I am glad I had that experience because it allowed me to really talk with the community. I was fighting for a lot of the same stuff that I'm fighting for now, simply at the school level, ensuring we have career development centers, as well as investing in, again, more mental health and ensuring that everyone is able to thrive. And one thing that came up constantly, besides those three key issues when I was running, was the cost of living as well as homelessness. Now, there's not much, of course, that a school board member can do about homelessness. But this means I have been in the trenches talking with voters and talking to our communities about their biggest issues, which includes a wide variety of things I want to ensure are all part of an interconnected solution through a comprehensive plan, which I have developed and I am eager to get into later on in this conversation.
Yeah, we're definitely excited to get into that going forward. Terrence, I didn't get the chance to ask you, but have you run for public office before?
No.
So,
no.
And we're not going to, we love that as well.
Yeah, thank you. newcomers are welcome.
Newcomers are absolutely welcome. So why now to run for public office?
Yeah, I think for me, the last 4 years, our city did a really beautiful thing. I think we're very conscious of what communities of color has been through historically in our country, quite frank. And I think I loved that we were aware, we were conscious. But I think what happened along the way is communities of color lost some of their unique voices in those conversations. And I just want to bring that unique voice back. No communities of color are monolithic, right? We all have different thoughts, different views. And I just want to bring a unique one. And I thought that being formerly incarcerated, working on different restorative justice commissions, working with the Justice Integrity Unit under Mike Schmidt, District Attorney's Office, I thought I could bring something unique. I work on the community oversight for the FIT, the Focus Intervention Task Force. And I thought what I can bring is like rebuilding community with policing and getting us safe again in a way that our officers are not causing new harm. And because I lost a cousin to police violence, I wanted to bring that lived experience to the table with officers and get the normalization and humanization of both officers and community back on the table and make community policing really make sense, right? Not just this term we drop out to get people riled up, but make it very practical.
Yeah, we'll definitely get more into that as well as we move forward. And so, Steph, I know we talked shortly before this. This is also your first time running for public office. Can you also speak to this question? Why now?
Sure. I wish I could say that I already knew that Terrence and Dean were going to run and I could run alongside them, but I think one of the reasons this new form of elections, I don't think that I ever would have run one in an at-large seat because I do care. I mean, I think we have to be thinking about the whole city, of course, but I do think that East Portland, as Dean alluded to, has been underinvested for so long, and that attention is so important in a districting environment, and so that was really compelling. And the other thing is, that we're also we're all running as candidates for this new form of government, but we're also running as candidates in this new form of elections. And the proportional representation ranked choice vote, the multi-member system, I had a feeling through advocating for the charter reform would advantage collaboration and a more, I think, a more nourishing environment for democracy through this. And I've been delighted so far that I think that has held up. Like, you know, we see each other, or at least I see all of our, they're not opponents, you know, they're colleague candidates, and we're all learning together, and we do complement, you know, we're kind of looking for complementary, you know, we're differentiating, sure, but we're also working on finding alignment, and that, I think people are really tired of tear down politics. I don't think that that's great for democracy, and to have this new form of elections, I have a pretty steep history in coalition building, and I've just I felt like I had some value to offer during this campaign environment, and it's just been such a delight. I mean, more than I would have even thought to really meet so many candidates, and there are over 100 right now. We've met a lot of them, but that we've. I haven't met a candidate that I didn't like, you know, that I really deeply enjoy everyone, like everyone at this table, and everyone who I've met so far there. And that alone is, it's infusing a hope that, that I'm just so deeply appreciative. That was a much longer answer.
Should have done, but there it is. But that was a really, that was a really great thing to say, because I think, amazing. Yeah, and seeing how all of you interacting with you, it really speaks to the possibilities of this charter reform. Really, the positive, positive things.
Yeah. Here's the hope.
We hope. So far, so good.
Thanks.
So maybe we'll do a quick reset. We'll get into some more questions after that. You're listening to Running on Air, a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Reed Johnson. Today, we're speaking with candidates from District 1. I have here with me Steph Routh, Terrence Hayes, and Dean Salazar. And you can join the conversation, you the listener, by calling in with your questions to the Air Room at 503-231-8187 or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. We can get back to the conversation. Let's keep the positive feelings going. I'm not going to ask any of the heavy questions yet.
Good vibes.
The good vibes.
So I've got a good vibe question to begin with. This next little section. And maybe now I'll start with...
Steph said Terrence.
Yeah, we'll start with Terrence. I like this. It's a democratic process.
It is. It's been decided.
Terrence, what do you think Portland is doing well right now? How would you continue that? Or you see yourself fitting into that?
Yeah, I think we're continuing to do music really well and food really, really well. And since I love both, especially food, I want to continue to boast that out in a big picture way for our city. And I think we have things we're all trying to, you know, we know we got homelessness and drugs and those things that we're all wrestling with. But we can't miss what makes this city amazing, which is the way we serve and care for each other, especially in music and in food. So if I could do anything amazing and positive, it would be to remind this country that Portland is the place to go to meet amazing people, have great food, especially our food carts, right? Have great food and amazing variety of music.
And Dean, maybe I'll ask you the same question.
Yeah, I actually really like that he brought up food and music. I actually just went to some food carts earlier today. And regarding the music industry, that is correct. And I think we should actually use the built-in head start we have here in chips manufacturing contracts here in Portland to really integrate music and tech into a bigger combined arms industry coalition. I think that if we invested in that and ensuring the musicians are able to actually be able to afford to live here and ensuring that tech is incentivized to invest here in Portland, because we have so many great programmers here. I've met so many. So if we really focus on fleshing that out and making it a lot more comprehensive, then we have the opportunity here to create a sort of mini Silicon Valley in the positive way, not the you know. And so I think that could be a really big opportunity here in Portland. But in order to do that, we first have to make Portland safe. We have to make Portland clean. We have to make Portland attractive to an investment. We have to ensure that we are already investing in the people where it matters, especially in blue-collar jobs. Because if we don't do that, we're going to have a hard time attracting business here to Portland. But I think that we can do that, and I'm really have my heart set on making Portland maybe the best city in the entire West Coast, maybe west of the Mississippi.
Well, thank you. And Steph, same question.
Yeah, you're going to find out quickly that I'm a long form gal in a soundbite world. I'm so sorry.
We appreciate that. This is the platform for it.
Thank heavens. You know, I think one thing that I think is so incredible about Portland and Oregon is that we're willing to try things. We're willing to innovate. We're willing to be the first. And that kind of goes along with creativity, with the arts, you know, that is that creativity also in policy form. I've been thinking, you know, we're in a transition, we're in a critical transition at a very challenging time in our collective history. And so I've been reading a lot, you know, Franklin Delano Roosevelt and Lyndon Johnson and Abraham Lincoln and, you know, some of the, you know, those folks that we've never met. But I've been struck by Franklin Delano Roosevelt did a pretty incredible speech for Oglethorpe University where he says, you know, that the important thing is to try something. And if something doesn't work, then admit it honestly, but above all, try something. And I feel like we have done that with voter registration, you know, that we have, Oregon has the highest voter participation in the nation because we allow people to, you know, vote naked. that's pretty neat. You don't need pants. we have the Portland Clean Energy Fund, you know. We tried, you know, we worked on Measure 110 and however you feel like, I think it was really important. It is really important to recognize that addiction is at base a health issue. It is not a crime. And so how do we get closer to that? The issue is, of course, that, you know, other aspects of our safety net, social safety net are lacking, you know, that we don't have universal health care. There's a lot of things that get in the way, but that we can talk about. But I just love the amount of innovation. And I think, you know, this form of elections to government is another one of those. So that we're willing to try.
May I follow up on that? I actually really like that answer. Great, thank you. So I'm really glad that you mentioned all that, including, you know, FDR's famous try, and if things don't work out, try otherwise. And I want to focus here on two specific factors. One thing is that FDR, as you all know, did the New Deal, which is actually what I modeled my homelessness program after. It's designed to provide mental health care, job training, employment opportunities, sobering services, all at designated shelter and camp locations, just like the New Deal, in a way that is modernized and streamlined and really cuts through a lot of what we currently see of the current city gridlock. And second, regarding Measure 110 and trying new things, one thing that's interesting is that I do believe Measure 110 is a failed experiment, but it was an experiment, and I'm glad we experimented with it. At the same time, our district, District 1, voted heavily against Measure 110. It was defeated in our district. And one thing that I actually know Anthony Johnson, the guy who wrote 110, great guy, but I think his views were just misguided in regards to because we didn't really build any structures to deal with the addiction and stuff like that beforehand, because that was always going to lead to an increased caseload. And since we have so few services, as I alluded to earlier, we have so few mental health access services, that was always going to be a problem. So I think it was an interesting idea at the wrong time and is something that does not reflect our district's values. And I think that it's something that we really need to look at of how do we deal with the aftermath of this. And a lot of that really includes ensuring that we have a modern response to modern problems. Fentanyl, nobody could have seen fentanyl coming. At the same time, we need to ensure that we are having honest conversations about this, and by talking and telling people that Look, it's not humane to be able to sleep on sidewalks and streets. It simply isn't. It causes people's mental health to deteriorate, and especially because so many of these people who are going onto the streets are actually coming from the foster care system, or they have some form of IDD. In fact, the Oregon Commission on Autism just got data a little while ago showing that 30 to 40% of the national homeless rate has some form of an intellectual or developmental disability. And that's definitely higher here in Oregon, just based on what we already know of our lack of services. So something I want to get into, I think that we need to really have good, honest conversations about what good policy is.
Absolutely. Yeah, I think you've all brought up really important policy points, priorities that you've mentioned in your campaigns. I really want to get into a lot of these pieces. And so maybe we'll start to shift into some more direct conversations about specific policy points. I want to begin with you, Terrence, and talk about policing in Portland. Right. You know, it's something that's on a lot of voters' minds. It's sort of answering this question is instrumental in shaping how we view Portland. You know, Terrence, you've already touched on this previously. You know, you've lived within the criminal justice system. You've worked with the criminal justice system. You know, you've mentioned you're formerly incarcerated. You've worked on the state's Criminal Justice Commission, Racial Justice Council. You also have, you know, your cousin was a victim of police violence. Mm-hmm. You know, you have this family tragedy as well. You also have garnered the endorsement of the police, Portland Police Union. Right. I was reading in a Willamette Week interview, you're also a staunch supporter of the Portland Police. Right. I wanted to kind of come at this and invert the idea of this endorsement. You know, not so much that you've applied for their support, but rather this question of why do you support them? Yeah, why are you? Yeah. So, maybe you can kind of get at that, and you know, how do you see Portland Police establishing trust with Portlanders as they've done with you?
Okay, I just want to make sure I don't miss the tough part first, which is, Terrence, why did you go after the PPA and why was it important? And so what I'll start is when my family experienced that loss, I was very clear and adamant from the beginning that there is a problem. There is a time lapse problem between the decision making for officers and lives lost, right? And so I always wanted to talk about how do we increase the time? How do we work with officers to normalize that extra breath in order to save lives? And then also inside of the Black community, how do we make sure we don't find our young man staring down the barrel of a police officer? And so what I realized is that in order for me to be the most impactful, I had to humanize officers as much as I expect them to humanize community. Our officers are going to be here. We can't take one-off incidents and demonize the totality of our first responders. And I thought that we, when we responded to George Floyd and things like that, and we expected better, we, in my opinion, we went too far because we neglected to care for officers who served without those levels of offenses. And I was conscious and aware of that. So I wanted to make sure that we had a seat at the table with our officers, that we can challenge them to be the best version of themselves, and that I can garner trust and enough trust to tell truths and be honest. When I went after the PPA endorsement and we were interviewing, I talked about my cousin and my concern with that extra breath and that extra second, and how do we get officers to buy into normalizing that extra second and not just feeling like they're also at risk, right? Because our officers are often trained like, if you don't respond fast enough, it could be your life. And that's not an unfair assessment. We've seen officers be hurt also. I wanted to bring honest conversation. And because our officers are not going nowhere, I think it's very problematic to say that we simply wanted to demonize them and we simply want to ignore them. And then what we end up doing is over those 4 years of challenge, we actually end up causing more rifts and separation. And so when we talk about Measure 110, one of the big things I've always said is that part of its failure is that it was it was the narrative was created. It's also almost like we're going to show officers, right? Instead of the heart of 110, we were talking about it as if it was contrary to how officers viewed criminalizing drugs, instead of working with our police force and going, look, this is actually better for you also. So there was a narrative issue. And so when we go from 4,000 arrests for drug possession to 400 tickets or to get people to go to court, that's a problem. And I've seen that problem. And it's a narrative problem. Black people did not become anti-police. It's not a true narrative. Abolitionists don't want police, and that's fair because that's their worldview. But they did it on the back of black trauma and black pain, and it did not perfectly represent black community concerns. And so as a black man, as we can see, I wanted to bring the voice of the black community, the concerns, right? And I wanted to make sure that that voice is at the table. So when I sought out the PPA endorsement, it was because I wanted to have access, honest, true access, to have real dialogue with our officers. I just resigned, but I was the chair of the Focus Intervention Task Force Community Oversight Group. And one of the big things I wanted to do when I signed up for that group is build healthy relationship with the officers that was tasked to reduce gun violence in our city. And that primarily was seen in black and brown communities. So I want to have honest dialogue. And so one of the things I did was I said, look, can we talk about how you engage young black and brown men when you pull them over? Don't assume that a nervous young black man means criminality. There is a narrative that that young man is fighting, which is, am I going to make it out of here safely? And the officer's resounding response is like, Terrence, I'm not coming up to a car thinking about taking a life. So I had to eat the humanity of their concerns. So what I said was, how about we just say, how are you doing? How about before we make any assumptions, we ask that young black or brown man, are you okay? How are you doing? And even if we don't get the best response, we say, are you okay? How are you doing? And so my 16-year-old son got pulled over, and I don't even know the officer that did it, but I asked my son, how did it go? Because he's still my son, and I'm still a black man in America, so I had concerns. And my son said the officer just kept asking, how are you doing? I said, was you nervous? He said, yeah. I said, how many times did he ask you? He said he just kept asking. So that is, I am not pro or anti. Right? These whole concepts actually divide and cause more problems. I am focused on data and results, right? So when I say we're 500-600 officers short, that is not pro-police. That is just national standards and data, right? How we address that as a city is our decision, especially when it comes to city council. We have to be honest about how that number impacts the city, right? So I haven't come to be pro or anti anything. I've come to preserve the lives of people in this city, to help us rebuild trust. And that was why it was important, because when you work with officers who've never pulled the trigger, who've always showed up every day to serve community, you start humanizing officers again. And I didn't, you know, for me, most people speak about the loss that me and my family endured. They don't know how it felt. Right. And they don't know how it feels to be a person who've experienced that and still want to build with our officers so we get the best version of our officers that engage in our community every day. And so I stand on that decision because I want to be at that table. I want officers to trust when I talk about community engagement, and I won't make any decisions that separate me from having access to the people that have to respond to our community every day.
Well, thank you so much, Terrence, for that response. I want to keep the conversation with this subject and include Steph and Dion in it. We're going to go to a midway song really quick, just to give you all a little break as well, and give our listeners a little music too. So we're going to cut to that, and then we're going to come back and continue this conversation. Support for Running on Air comes from KBOO members and the League of Women Voters. More information about the candidates on your ballot can be found on the League of Women Voters of Portland's website, lwvpdx.org. The League has videos of candidate interviews and forums, as well as links to candidates' written answers to questions and explanations of ballot measures. That's lwvpdx.org. And if you're just tuning in, you're listening to Running on Air. We're here with District 1 candidates Steph Routh, Terrence Hayes, and Deanne Salazar. Terrence, we just heard from you. I really appreciate your response to this question of policing, the work that you've done, you know, reforming the criminal justice system, speaking with police officers, you know, building around this idea of increased time to normalize an extra breath in the responses. I want to now draw the conversation to you, Steph. I know your campaign has a sort of a different approach to this question of policing. I saw that you run your campaign on a no police money pledge. Mm-hmm. What priority does that set for your campaign?
That is a great question. Thank you for asking. I know, I was like, I know how you're going to say this. We have a, I'll just back up again, long form. We have a pledge policy on our campaign. And in fact, the no police money pledge is basically the only pledge that we have signed. And the reason that we signed it and there's been a lot of, you know, it's like, oh, you're anti-police. It's like, no, police are an entire bureau. They are a critical community safety partner. And as Terrence has said, and as a counselor, like, I want to legislate over all bureaus, and one of those bureaus is police. I also feel strongly, you know, accountability and transparency and responsiveness in government are really important. And the police bureau, police officers are the, to the best of my understanding, the only employees in the city that have the authority to take a life. And I think that that does take an elevate accountability. I do not have the relationship that that others have, that Terrence has with police previously. As the former executive director of Oregon Walks, I did some work with the traffic division, but that was over 10 years ago. And so I wanted to start this relationship with kind of as how I chose a desire to govern better, like to have a kind of a baseline for governance. And that means, you know, accountability, and that means to not take police money. But I have been, and I've really been grateful for Sergeant Schmautz, who's the chair of the PPA, I've been grateful that he's sat down with me a couple of times. We've developed a relationship, and I'm hopeful that we can develop that relationship and appreciate, you know, that centering of humanity. I think it is important that we see each other as individuals and humans first. And also, one thing that I would love to see, you know, as we're talking about police recruitment, is more police officers being Portlanders. That we can see, right? Yes. That we know that police officers see the person in front of them as a neighbor first, and so that's something that I would really like to foster. I also think, you know, stepping back, that, you know, Terrence mentioned community policing. I think, you know, that community safety involves police as a partner, but they're not the only partner. And I think that we also need to diversify our portfolio of what community safety means. You know, it also means after school programs. It does mean environmental design in some ways, because a lot of our deaths in our city are also traffic crashes. And so, you know, how are we designing our systems better? How are we getting upstream? How are we creating connections among neighbors to keep each other safe? And I think that, you know, building that culture of belonging and safety includes things like, you know, ensuring that parks are welcoming places of belonging, where people can feel safe, where they can build connections and can start to really see their neighbors as part of their community. So I think that there's a lot of pieces, and I don't know if I answered your question, but
no, that's a fantastic answer. Deanne, I wanted
to... You're very kind. What?
I agree. That was a great answer.
Oh, I love you too.
Now, Deanne, I wanted to give you an opportunity to talk about policing, but if you don't mind as well, I would love to kind of bring in some new topics and have you begin maybe our next section, if that's all right with you.
Sure.
Yeah. So, you know, Portland finds itself in a housing crisis. Beyond that, a crisis of rental prices. The city and the county has put forward millions of funds towards, you know, addressing gaps in the housing stock. Dion, on your campaign website, you couple homelessness and housing together. You propose creating a homelessness and housing office in the
Correct.
City to, and I quote from your website, to comprehensively and swiftly address the issues as interconnected problems. Can you
Yes.
talk more about this decision, coupling together, and how that would work with the Joint Office of Homeless Services?
Yes. So one thing that the city has been doing for far too long is not treating these two as interconnected, not just as problems, but as solutions. We need to ensure that one policy feeds into the other. And so if we have a Department of Homelessness and Housing, or we can even name it something like Public Works, which would also include the Water Bureau, there's lots of options we can go with that route, then we would actually be able to deal with these problems a lot more swiftly, especially if we integrate it with other things like Portland Street Response, Community Health Assess and Treat, and a lot of other stuff. So what I'm really focused on is ensuring that we're able to do as much as possible by ensuring that we are giving our bureaus and our bureaucracy the tools they need and reducing the amount of paperwork they have to do to make decisions and ensuring that they are also able to work and collaborate with other members of the community. One thing in particular that I want to focus on is that I think that we've been pushing living alone as a solution for far too long that does not necessarily work for everybody. For example, a lot of people who deal with mental health issues need someone who can also aid them in their tasks and stuff like that. So I really want to incentivize a lot more shared housing and also intergenerational housing, because I think that when I look at the histories of housing in other countries, in particular Japan, I think that actually has a real potential to allow us to build denser and to have a lot more people live in denser areas while also having people's mental health, as long as we invest in good policy and good family policy and stuff like that, good training, all stuff like that, to allow them to be able to live together and be able to afford things more. What we're really experiencing is a lack of affordability. Mm-hmm. That comes due to how, for example, city housing vouchers, rental assistance vouchers are 1 year only, which does cause some problems. But it's also a fact that we aren't having people's incomes raised fast enough to deal with cost of living and inflation and stuff like that. So that's why I do believe that blue-collar jobs, which is the core of my platform, ensuring that we're able to get these people into these opportunities, ensure that they have the skill sets and the training they can. And then there's also the market for those same opportunities and skill sets and trades and stuff like that. That will allow us to deal with it a lot faster and a lot more efficiently. And I think that we need to do that while also investing in stuff like more mixed income housing. Mm-hmm. And we need to really broaden the portfolio of the types of housing that we are even looking at. I know there are several types and even ways of constructing buildings that we simply don't even consider here in Portland or even in America in general. So we need to look at all options so that we have the best ability to deal with these problems and tailor our solutions to the needs of the specific community we are trying to serve.
I love that. Yeah, a more global sort of perspective as well. You know, going off this question of affordability, maybe I'll draw on Terrence now. So I want to also draw from your campaign website. You know, you talk under this headline of affordability, you talk about economic empowerment,
right,
helping small businesses, encouraging entrepreneurship. Can you talk more about coming at this affordability crisis from this angle?
Yeah. So I honestly believe that we have to be honest about the fact that as our city felt less safe and less clean, money started leaving, right? We tax generally the higher incomes in our city, and we serve our city through that taxation. And generally, people will let you tax them really high if our services look really well. And so I think we have to be honest about the fact, how do we bring private money back? How do we bring investors back? And I don't want to say private money because I know people demonize this concept. I'm simply saying, how do we bring outside money to invest in our city and its people? How do we bring high-wage jobs into our city? We know that the trades is one of the best ways to do that. And I think we did this thing for a long time where we were so college focused that we demonized the trades, and now it's paying better with less debt. And I think as much as we as a society and as a community put into pressing college, we have to press the trades as a legit way to rebuild our middle class. And we have to develop, we have to build, we have to get focused on cleaner energy. Steph, I love Steph because when I have questions about clean energy and I come with these small concepts of like, what about electric cars? She's like, it got to be bigger. And I think we have to become bigger. And as a city, we have to invest in this bigger idea that we can love on our environment and take care of people and bring new industry and new work into these spaces. I know that most people who are homeless had jobs or have jobs. The data is saying that we got to make it affordable. We have to find a way to get people into homes faster. And one of the things I really want to talk to City Council about when we get there is like, how do we challenge landlords and building owners and all this to bring down that three times the rent? That doesn't get people housed, right? Listen, we can't say we have our rental cost is too high and we're not making enough money. People can struggle, but they'll still be sheltered. So we need to think about lowering our standards of entry into homes, right, and into shelter, and then us as a city being prepared to subsidize folks when they have hard times to make sure that they don't become homeless. But we have to do that holistically. I agree with Deanne. Like, we have to take it holistically, and we have to learn from our past mistakes and just do better.
Thank you, Terrence. Okay, I'm going to just do a quick reset, and then, Steph, I want to come at you with the next question. I got one burning under my fingernails. If you're just listening, you're listening to Running on Air. It's a production of KBOO Community Radio. I'm your host, Reed Johnson. We're speaking with candidates from District 1. I have with me Steph Routh, Terrence Hayes, and Deanne Salazar. You can join the conversation by calling in with your questions to the Air Room, although act fast, at 503-231-8187, or by messaging us on the KBOO website, kboo.fm. So now, coming back to our discussion, we can keep it with affordability, we can go in different directions, but in particular, I want to draw our attention to District 1 and touch on something, Steph, you mentioned early on, that you were so excited to enter in the race, particularly because you're able to represent District 1. It's something that you kind of really make very clear and explicit mm-hmm. in your campaign. Yep. You're a District 1 local. You're born in
Park Rose.
Mm-hmm. And you speak to seeing the area annex into Portland. You know, that was a process you said came with sort of unrealized promises of resources to the community, unrealized so far. Can you talk about how you as city councilor would use your position to platform for District 1?
Oh, that's my favorite. And I just want to pause, like, because this is radio, what you didn't see was when Dean and Terrence were both answering, like, everyone was nodding. Like, I'm just so excited for the future of Portland.
Yeah, thank you for mentioning that.
I think one thing, it's not a coincidence that I was the first executive director of Oregon Walks and a longtime East Portlander, because, you know, we've made East Portland a pretty convenient place to drive through, less of a nourishing place to live in. And I think that building place making is just so critical to that. I have the joy of serving. Currently, there's a collaborative working group where we're working on something called the The technical term is the economic opportunity analysis, which looks at, it's just a really, like, I just feel like pushing up my glasses when I say it, but it's looking at what do, and I think this goes to what both Dion and Terrence were talking about of, you know, what do the next 20 years of buildable lands need to be in industry? Because we do have a lot of folks in East Portland whose livelihoods and lives are built around the trades and around frontline work. And so, you know, how are we, I think we need to ask questions in this place now that we're looking at what does the economic prospect of our city look like post-COVID? And what does, our economy has changed pretty substantively. Our industrial lands, I'm going to get a tiny bit nerdy, our industrial lands has actually shifted to be our those lands are used a lot more for warehousing and distribution, for, you know, like e-commerce is just one. It's not the only, but it's one driving feature. And so I think the questions that we really need to ask are, you know, what is our jobs per acre that we're looking at? What is a good job? When we are talking about what good jobs need to be and we are looking at, you know, what do we need to be preparing for on a 20-year time horizon, what does that mean for, and then also how are we ensuring that there is a pipeline of apprenticeships, of trades, and also, you know, Dion mentioned the CHIPS Act, you know, how, because there is a close relationship between trades and work. Like, my brother is a physicist. He works in the semiconductor industry. And so, like, there's a large confluence in our region of interdependent economic need. And so how are we building that into our land use? And also, how are we able to live next to it? Live in, and that is something that is coming, you know, in Park Rose, coming to high relief. I went to Park Rose Middle School. I went to Park Rose High School. I will just put on the table, it makes me deeply frustrated that Prologis is building a facility three blocks away from the Park Rose Middle and High Schools. That would not happen. I don't think that would happen if that were in Laurelhurst. Mm. That wouldn't happen if it was inner east. Yeah. But there was not a buffer between residential and industrial. And I think that is just such a huge example, an important example of, you know, how we are intentionally or unintentionally, without intention, building our neighborhoods. And so I think one thing that I'm hopeful that we can look at is, you know, how is that as we're looking to, you know, build more housing and we are looking to preserve our industrial lands, what is the interface between this and how do we have an intentional conversation? Eugene just passed something, and I'm just going to stand on it for a minute, something called the public health overlay zone. Like, how are we, that interface between residential and industrial, like, how can we create the conditions for having an intentional conversation about how to protect the our priorities for both? Because they're both important, they're both needed, and they do have some overlapping tension that we need to have intentional conversations, because right now I think East Portland, so many neighborhoods are experiencing the lack of those conversations, and neighbors feel rightfully so that they have been left to their own devices for decades.
Thank you, Steph. I want to draw Dion and Terrence into the conversation, if you allow me. I know we only have about 8 minutes left, but I want to touch on, in particular, something that Steph brought up, the economic prospects of the city. Yes. And I know Dion and Terrence, both of your campaign websites emphasize workforce development.
Yes.
And Dion, you have a policy idea to create a network of local union industrial manufacturing centers Do you mind talking about that for a little bit? What does that look to you?
Yes. So one thing that if you walk through East Portland, you'll notice the fact that there are a lot of businesses due to the high rates of homelessness and crime, and simply the lack of profitability due to Portland's decreased reputation and stuff like that, and the less people spending. You'll notice that there are a lot of things closing down. I think that we can actually turn this crisis into an opportunity by retooling them into facilities that can build small, obviously they can't be like big industrial machinery projects, at the very least not at the current time, but they can be really converted into stuff where you can work in stuff like, say, clay ceramics, because that is something that someone could do, and that is something that could be union run, even maybe even like a union business itself. And so we need to really reimagine how we are thinking about what could this place be? How do we do it? Because if we are going to ensure that East Portland is not just a place where low-income people live, but where they thrive and where they're able to exchange and to partake in the market, then it's going to take a dramatic reimagining of what does our district look like? Because it's one of the least walkable districts, I would say. And also, I think we need to expand homeownership as well. So we, again, have to invest in all of these interconnected solutions and also ensure that we're working with local businesses, local industry, and attracting business to East Portland, which, again, will require that we deal with the homelessness crisis in a way that's humane, sensible, swift, and does not have people living on the sidewalks. And we need to also ensure that we have more police, because a lot of these businesses are closing down because they're getting broken in or having like shoplifting frequently. I've seen this on my own right near where I live. So we need to ensure we are building the facilities on existing facilities, because we have a lot of land here that is not being currently used due to the crisis we have. So if we simply turn this crisis into an opportunity to build a new kind of economic ecosystem, then we should be well prepared to invest in our interconnected long-term strategy and goals over several years.
Yeah, that's a really powerful image you draw there. Terrence, I want to also ask you, you're a small business owner yourself. You mentioned that, you know, Restore Nuisance Abatement. This is a business where you employ formerly incarcerated people. You offer training. How does that shape your approach to workforce development?
Yeah. I think I've done workforce development. And when I think about workforce development, what I'm thinking about is creating the next workforce, right? How do we get the next generation involved? How do we get people in this generation, you know, for the 40s, right? In this generation, how do we get them to buy into that they can pick up something new and be very successful? And when you look at, I say the undesirable workforce, which I think is a huge workforce, and that undesirable is more about image and not reality. Because when people come home, they have a hard to be great. They have a hard to work hard, and they're really trying, right? And so if we look at those folks and we start to create a pathway for them to pick up the trades and skill sets, to invest in their entrepreneurial dreams, to give them the support that they need to learn how to run a business, even in a very fundamental way. They have the heart, they don't have the lived experience. And so I felt like one of the unique things I could do is love on that community of folks to make sure that they had pathways to provide. And we've been really blessed that the folks we've hired has not committed new crimes. They are being able to get themselves housed, because we do prevailing wage work, and that they've been able to take care of their families. So if we want to build out a new workforce, we have to think differently than we historically have. We got to bring some new concepts and ideas, and I think it start with reimagining rebuilding interests in the trades, right? We've treated it like dirty work, but it's served our community since we've industrialized, right? The trades have kept us flowing. So for me and our company, our commitment is to help community safety and get folks who might be at higher risk of committing crimes working. And when you work somebody and they work their butt off and you pay them well, the facts show, the data show that they're less likely to commit crimes. And then we create generational pathway out of criminality. We can stop that wheel.
Sorry, I hate to interject. But
yeah, we only have about 1 minute, so if you could just keep it very brief.
All right. Yeah, so two things that he brought up, that investing in small businesses. This is why I think we need a city-run venture capital firm with, in exchange for low stakes, we can ensure that businesses are being given the support that they need to succeed. And secondly, I'm glad that he's talking about building the next workforce, and that means that we need to invest in youth. So that means after we deal with the homelessness crisis and have my program help deal with that, then we can expand that to BIPOC communities, minimum wage workers, youth, low-income communities, and even people, maybe potentially people working in high school, because that is going to be important if we are going to set them up and our economy for long-term success.
Okay. Yeah. Thank you so much for including that as well. I think that's really important, people to consider as well. We're just wrapping up right now. I wanted to ask a very quick question. Hopefully it's a very quick question. One place that defines District 1 for you, and maybe we can begin with Steph.
Come on.
I thought it might be a quick question, but maybe
go.
A number of us were there this past weekend, but Leavitt View Park I just absolutely love it. It has a look to Mount Hood.
Beautiful. And Terrence.
Beautiful. Jenny Sacred Grounds, locally owned coffee shop that ain't corporate, just an individual amazing lady that loves the community.
And Dean as well. Close us out.
Yeah, it's tough for me because it's between Gateway, that area, that district. But I have to go with my home school, David Douglas. I think that it really represents the future of what East Portland will look like, and I'm really excited to see so many of these people entering the workforce and being able to dream again, because we need to ensure that people have the ability to hope and not just live day to day just trying to make it get by. They need to be able to thrive, and that's what I hope for us
thank
to be able
so
to
much,
do.
Thank you so much, Dean. Thank you all. You've been listening to the I'm sorry, I have to close out. And you've been listening to Running on Air, produced at KBOO Radio in Portland, Oregon. I've been here with Terrence Hayes, Dean Salazar, and Steph Routh from District 1. You can find all the episodes of Running on Air on KBOO's website. That's kboo.fm/runningonair. Episodes are also available wherever you get podcasts. Thank you to all the KBOO volunteers who helped to make this happen. Our engineers are Althea Billings, Bob Davis, and Arthur Risotto. Our producer is Althea Billings, and our editor is Eric Leuschner. Tune in to the next episode of Running on Air. It'll be with candidates from District 2 at 10 a.m. tomorrow. That's Tuesday, September 10th. I've been your host, Reed Johnson. Thanks for listening. Thanks to the candidates. Have a good night.